Hello, I am Jennifer Stover with the Binghamton DIY Punk Archive. I'm here at Punkfest, May 28th, 2022, and I am here doing an interview with
Kevin Sheridan.
Can you spell your last name for us, Kevin?
Sheridan.
Thank you. And we're going to do a brief interview about punk. Do you mind if we include it as part of our online archive?
Not at all.
Awesome. Let's get started. So, if you could tell us a little bit about yourself.
Well, I was the product of a suburban childhood in the vicinity of Albany, New York. Albany, Schenectady, Troy, the Tri-Cities. At the time, let's see, I'd say it was in high school when I started getting into, I guess, what you would call heavy music. And the high school was a very sort of class caste system, where you had a sort of a yuppie set that listened to the proper music, and then the heavy metal kids who sat and smoked and were basically assumed to be going to, you know, learn shop class. I kind of fell in between a number of these castes, and well, I started getting into heavy metal through the usual Black Sabbath, Iron Maiden, some of the classic rock that my older brothers liked, Rush, Triumph, that sort of thing. I started getting into the harder, more underground scenes through people I knew, friends of mine from high school. Now, at the time, the big scene in Albany was the punk hardcore scene. Actually, let me revise that. The hardcore scene.
Yeah.
These music scenes were often quite political. Like, for example, we're at a punk show right now, and at the time, if I showed up at a punk or hardcore scene with the sort of longish hair I had, I'd probably get beat up. So one of the thing that, there were a lot of subcultures and sub-subcultures, and we all had our mythologies about the others. Like, for example, all the metal kids knew, and I'm doing quotes here, that all the hardcore kids were either, straight edge kids who would beat you up if you even implied that you wanted a cigarette or a beer, or that they were neo-Nazis. And all of the hardcore kids knew, air quotes again, that the metal kids were all druggies and listened to just hair bands. I think the thing that really broke that down was the crossover scene. Bands like DRI, Verbal Abuse, Black Flag. That's when these groups started really interacting. And I know there's a band called The Obsessed, who came out of a sort of the stoner, well, we didn't call it that back then, but they would just play really fast at times and play over the PA when their PA is dead, and the punks was like, oh, okay, I guess you're all right. And sort of my interaction with people and going to shows and going to, and hanging out at, you know, basement jam sessions, they knew that I was into heavy metal and that sort of thing. So they would think that my music was always sort of weak. So, but that's also when I was getting into the grindcore scene, which was, you know, I would be laughed at and then say, oh, here's Bolt Thrower. And I would put that in, and it was the nastiest, heaviest thing that anyone ever heard, Realm of Chaos, and they're like, oh, okay, well, maybe that's, you know. And a lot of it is, it's just, you just find yourself running into people's preconceptions about what you believe, what you enjoy, what your scene is. And I even saw this amongst the punk scene. Earlier I said the hardcore scene, not the punk scene.
Yes, that's a division.
Because there was the...
It was, anyway.
Punk's Not Dead, right? That was the shirt. And yeah, then you would see the hardcore kids with Punk is Dead, You're Next. So, yeah, that was interesting.
What years were you in high school?
87 to 91. So long ago.
I graduated in 92, so it couldn't have been that long ago. But yeah, what you're describing, I'm from Southern California, and it's very similar. It brings back a lot of memories for me, mm-hmm. and how and why those divisions seem to matter so deeply at the time.
And today they're meaningless.
Yeah, we're definitely seeing something very different happening out there.
I saw someone wearing a Celtic Frost t-shirt with punk attire. That would have been unheard of.
Stevie Nicks t-shirt.
Yeah.
I think people are wearing the band's t-shirts who are here, which was mm-hmm. a thing that we thought we were too cool to do.
Yeah, yeah.
Do you have, and I also appreciate like talking about this because I think when people do interviews and oral histories, we're always like, feel like, you know, it's kind of the only talking about the fun moments. Mm-hmm. And it's important, I think, to remember some of those, you know, definitely important to remember the tensions and the potential violence and mm-hmm. other things that went on at shows too. It's not mm-hmm. just about coming together through music, you know.
As an example, I went to college in SUNY Oswego, and if you went to shows up there, you did not go anywhere near the pit if you saw people like basically skinheads.
Yes.
And I am well aware that skinhead culture is much, much broader than you know what is depicted on the Geraldo Rivera. I'm dating myself here again, but especially up in that area, there were skinheads who we knew that they were based out of Fort Drum. They were military, but wow. also skinhead. Oh, yeah. Ugh. Yeah. And you did not go near the pit if you had longish hair, or you just did not want to go near the pit. For us, the defining thing was, I don't know if this is how it was in SoCal, shoelaces, bootlaces. Yeah.
Different colors.
What was it? White is white pride, blue is straight edge, green is queer skin, red is neo-Nazi, and those were the demarcations at least in upstate New York.
Yeah.
So
I'm trying to, those were the same in Southern California. I'm trying to remember, we did have a multiracial skinhead group called
Sharp.
The Unity Skins,
mm-hmm.
who would basically go to shows to beat everyone's asses who had neo-Nazi.
Right.
And that was, you know, part of the scene was that interracial unity, mm-hmm. very much based like out of two-tone ska and mm-hmm. and, you know, punk. And
you ever see Hyrax?
I did not.
You know
No, I don't.
They're a crossover thrash band. They have an African-American singer, Caton DePenna. I think he's one of the best thrash metal singers out there. He has this really low bass that kind of Bon Scotty, but he can also like hit into the Dio era, you know.
Oh, yeah.
Check them out, Hyrax. Their logo was actually developed by Tom G. Warrior of Celtic Frost.
Oh, that's
so
awesome.
So they're, yeah.
I was going to ask you if you like Escuela, if you've heard of Escuela. They're a grindcore band.
No.
Yes. They lived in Ithaca briefly. They're from Texas and lived in Ithaca for 4 or 5 years. And they're really awesome.
Yeah.
Three piece. I don't know if they have a bass, but they have. And I can't remember.
I'm
the name
biased.
Of their singer. There's a female singer that is really, really awesome.
Well, I'll tell you one of the. I mean, this may be a bit far afield from punk, but maybe not. I was a DJ in Oswego. I was one of the metal DJs.
Oh, that's what's their called numbers?
Called
letters. Sorry.
I think WNYO.
Oh, that's very cool.
I don't even know if they're still around anymore. And I was there. I mean, I had been in the death metal scene. Doom metal is sort of that's my pride and joy. I love death metal. And then when Asphyx, which was like the first doom death band, came out, I was like, this is mine. But I remember getting some of the first Norwegian black metal bands in. And talk about a politically conflicted era. That was, I think, probably the first time that I really had to confront the whole concept of, can you separate art from artist? Because I heard these CDs from this band that I really liked. Their music was great, but this band was called Burzum. I'm sure you're familiar with them.
I am
not. You're
not. Now
Okay, well, how familiar are you with the Norwegian black metal scene?
Not much.
Well, there was, the sort of defining event was, aside from the fact that they were actually going around burning down old churches, it was sort of like a revitalization movement, where they thought, okay, death metal had become, you know, they're talking about social issues and this and that. It should be about Satan and blood and spikes and all this and should play really raw. But the sort of unofficial leader of that movement was stabbed to death 30 times by his bandmate, Varg Vikernes.
Wow.
And he went to jail for a couple decades. I mean, that's, you know, Norwegian sentences. And now, but Varg Vikernes was also, he had this project called Burzum. And I remember listening to these albums, and it's very sort of atmospheric and showing that you could do a lot more with extreme music. But he became a very high-profile neo-Nazi. And that sort of crept into the scene. So I got to the point when I just couldn't deny. It's like, okay, I can't. And that's, I took all my Burzum albums and sold them. Something I did years later with Phil Anselmo. Mm-hmm. I'm sure you're familiar with that incident. Yeah. I got rid of all my, I don't know that I had any Pantera at that time, but I got rid of all my Down, Superjoint, Ritual, just gone. So that's something I'm pretty sensitive to in the scene. You know, the whole, I mean, especially in these days when, you know, I feel like right-wing extremism is worse than ever, worse than I've ever seen it. So I'm just thinking, you know, not in anything I'm going to support. I wouldn't say that I'm hyper aware of it, but I definitely, you know, keep tabs on which bands may be problematic, which bands are serious about it. And of course, it's the, you know, the obviously, one show that, one of my favorite shows I ever saw in high school was when Slayer came through. And I'm sure I'm sure you're familiar with the, you know, there's, but, you know, you see the imagery they use is the big German eagle with the Slayer logo on it. And of course, their song Angel of Death. But, you know, I read interviews with Jeff Hanneman, and he was saying, it's like, look, we're not supporting anything, we're portraying something. And, I mean, his perspective was, you know, if you need me to actually flat out tell you that Hitler was a bad person, you've got problems. Now, do I think they were Nazis? No. And I remember there's actually a really good series called Global Metal by a Canadian anthropologist who went to scenes all over the world, and he went to Israel. And they're talking about, they're talking with Israeli bands like Orphan Land and Salem, saying that, you know, how do you view Slayer? And it's like, you mean like Angel of Death? And this actually became a debate in the Knesset. They were saying, it's like, no, you can't talk about the Holocaust like that. This is sacred, you know. But other people saying, no, it's good that this is portrayed. It's good that this is how, and, you know, Salem said that they would play that, you know, they would play covers of that. On the other hand, you get bands that are especially, any black metal band from Finland, give them like 2-3 looks, because there's something, I don't know what it is about Finnish black metal bands, I don't know what it is about Polish black metal bands. Lots of neo-Nazi imagery. And, but that actually, that's interesting, because it gets back to some of the, I mean, this debate has gone on and on and on. And you see old pictures of, I mean, obviously the Sex Pistols, but even Susie Sue wearing a swastika armband. I mean,
yeah.
And how is that? I mean, let me ask you, how do you view that?
We were talking, I mean, you and I talked earlier about what is punk, and I was going to actually raise that question in thinking about, is this sense of, I feel like those early bands were, at least the way they claimed it, it was at this kind of provocation at mm-hmm. any and all costs, and mm-hmm. that nothing,
it just means this,
right?
Nothing, I'm holding up a middle finger.
Yes, and nothing should be sacred, and nothing, but I still kind of call bullshit on that, or the idea that there are different, like, it's not this flat sense of provocation, mm-hmm. that mm-hmm. that different things have different resonances. And I think that, or it's, some of it, you know, there's a, I want to say immature, but it's a, just kind of, it's a, like, wanting to be noticed or wanting to be, you know.
And I think, well, I think in the case of a lot of British bands, there was a sense that they were constantly told about how their parents were the greatest generation.
And they survived the Blitz.
And then, yes.
So they thought that was a way of rebelling against those stories.
We'll talk about, I mean, in terms of, like, you know, someone who used fascist propaganda, Lemmy, Motorhead.
Oh, yeah.
There's a picture of him in Hawkwind, way back when. You know, just sitting around, there's like a bunch of hippies, and then there's Lemmy sitting there, and he's got a swastika on his... Do I think Lemmy was a Nazi? No, not at all. In fact, I'm pretty sure that he was not. There was a... there's a famous story about when Motorhead was touring with Morbid Angel. And that's when they have, I don't know if you're familiar, David Vincent, who is a kind of quasi-fascistic, may still be, I don't know, member of the Church of Satan, who tried to show Lemmy a copy of this book called Siege, which was written by a neo-Nazi follower of Charles Manson.
Yeah,
so that's there's a lot of that. I don't know if you're familiar with that, the sort of the confluence of Charles Manson, neo-Nazism, certain elements of the Church of Satan, and other...
Yes, I grew up in Southern California.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, there you
and
go.
I grew
so,
up right near Fallbrook, and a lot of the major centers for...
like Boyd Rice and that bunch, whole... So David Vincent asked him what he thought of it. Lemmy took it, ripped it in half, threw it in a waste paper basket, and pissed on it in front of him. It's like, I don't care for it. So,
well, I was just going to say, I think it's like about this idea of access and who feels like in terms of provocation, like, it's like, who validates them to decide it doesn't mean that, you know? Mm-hmm. Like, it's this radioactive symbol that has this meaning that is coded into it and saying, this just means this, you know? And it's, you know, they're not the ones that get to decide that. At least Johnny Rotten and Susie Sue weren't the ones that get to decide that, to try to recode that symbol just to get a rise out of folks and be confrontational.
Mm-hmm.
Do you think, I guess, so that, like, aggression, I think one of the themes that has been running in our conversation in terms of punk is aggression.
Yeah.
And what do you think the role of aggression in punk and punk scenes is?
You know, the weirdest thing is I've been sort of wrestling with that my entire life. I think, going back to Lemmy, the reacting against toxic positivity,
mm-hmm.
if that makes sense.
Mm-hmm.
You're not pretending to be nice. I'd rather not be nice. You know, screw nice.
Yeah.
You know, nice props up structures. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
Now, aggression for its own sake can ultimately be destructive. Also, it's funny because I recently saw a clip of, there's this show Elementary. I don't know if you're from, it's like a modern retelling of,
yes.
It's got Lucy Liu, and they had an episode with death metal and goat horror on there. And Sherlock Holmes is saying, you know, listening is almost like riding a belt sander over your brain. Sometimes that's necessary. And I think that's kind of spot on, you know? But I think the... as a counterexample, if Claire here ever hears this, I'll be thrown out of the house and her family will hate me, but I hate... This is an example of the exact opposite of this. I hate Garrison Keillor. Hate him. He is everything that is wrong about the, what I would call toxic positivity. I don't know if, have you ever listened to Prairie Home Companion?
Yes, the mythology of the, you know, the amazing little town where everything...
Not just that, but the, you know, casual racism and homophobia and, but... He gets away with all of it because he's folksy. Well, you know, to that.
Yeah. Yeah.
So that's where I think aggression comes in, and I think it can be useful.
Yeah, yeah.
So don't tell Claire I said that. I mean, she kind of has an idea of that I'm not a fan, but I don't know if she knows that I have, like, major psychotic hatred for him.
Yeah, it's his just, voice is a trigger, definitely.
No, and I mean, this was even way before the Me Too issues that came out with him.
Yeah.
It's just that... You know, that certain things are just sacrosanct, I can't even talk right now, and should not be challenged because why? Well, because he has this cultural, you know, this cultural baggage, this cultural...
I don't know, it's interesting to think about if punk is still at that level, because, you know, I remember, you know, first seeing people with you know, getting hand tattoos because they wanted to stay committed to a punk rock lifestyle. And if they got hand tattoos, they could never get a straight job, or they get neck tattoos because back
facial
then,
tattoos now.
Yeah, that meant like you could not, even if you were tempted to go into the straight world, you
and
weren't going
tattoos
to,
are kind of, you know.
Yeah, very much just like, I guess really it's become body art in ways that back then it had different meanings. But then too, like it's chosen aggression as opposed to aggression being, I guess, sometimes it can be chosen aggression as opposed to aggression that is imposed on you or aggression that you grew up with in the house. And I feel like there was also in the 80s, 90s, a working out of that together.
Yeah, yeah, definitely.
With our generation.
Who is an authentic punk rock, you know, punk rocker? Can I ever be authentic having come from the suburbs? Or... And I think that's that sort of fed into what I should be listening to sometimes. Like, I should be listening to, like, doom metal or something that is not aggressive. Although doom metal can be aggressive in a way. But authenticity, I think, plays into it a lot. And maybe on different levels, too. Because, you know, you look at the grunge scene and then a lot of these post-grunge bands who were basically just, you know, created to, you know, the record companies don't say, let's find the next new original thing. They say, let's find some more of that and see how much we can milk it. So, and whether or not you consider like Green Day or something like that authentic punk. And I have to admit, back in the day, I was really, you know, as a dumb teenager, the whole poser, you know, posers versus thrashers thing. And I don't know, I've come to the point where, you know, my the determination for whether music is good or not is, do you like it? Yes, no, maybe, whatever, you know.
Yeah, yeah. And does it move you in some way? And something like it was really...
Although having a bass guitar in a band is that's non-negotiable.
Okay, we're ending on that note. That must be said. All right, thank you so much for talking with me today. And have a great rest of the show.
Thanks.